call a meeting of the House Committee on Rules to order for Monday, April 20th, also known as 420, because it's the 20th day of the fourth month. What were you thinking? I don't know. All right, we're going to start with opening public hearing on House Bill 3510. Erin, will you explain the measure?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3510 requires legislative measures to contain brief and impartial statement of problem measure is intended to solve. It does exempt resolutions, both concurrent and single chamber resolutions, from this provision.
Representative Barreto.
Well, happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Smith Warner, Representative Gilliam, who's not here, and committee members, Greg Barreto, Representative, House District 58. And this may be the shortest and simplest bill that you will have to work this session. But House Bill 3510 would add a short notification stating why the bill was drafted. When we initiate a legislative draft, there's only two questions that are asked. What is the problem that we're trying to fix, and what is the solution? The only purpose for House Bill 3510 is to bring clarity to why any bill is created. By including on any bill the first question in the legislative draft, what is the problem, it will more fully define the reason for which the bill is initiated. If we have this information on every bill, we can then better understand and evaluate the bill and see if it does indeed solve the problem. So this is just something that happened about a week and a half into the session, and we had a bill, and after about 30 minutes of discussing the bill, it was finally clarified as what the bill was there to fix, and none of us on the panel actually had a clue that that's what it was. And so to me, it seemed like a simple thing to be able to put on the bill what the bill is actually trying to solve.
Great.
That's it.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate it. I think you're right. This is a very straightforward bill, and I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
With that, close public hearing on House Bill 3510. And I would like to open a public hearing and work session on HCR 27. Erin, would you please read the measure?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. HCR 27 is a memorial to honor David Frohnmayer.
With that, I would like to call up the Honorable Senator Betsy Johnson, Bill Gary, and Marla Ray. Come on down.
You sit in the middle, the rose between two thorns.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16, and I had the great privilege and high honor of being one of the memorialists at Dave Frohnmayer's funeral memorial service just recently. I think Mr. Gary and Ms. Ray are going to make the case for the substance of the bill. I'm just here to say I think Dave Frohnmayer was one of the finest men Oregon has had the privilege of having in public service, a selfless and dedicated public servant, a memorial service attended by somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 people, poised and capable children who did for their father what I was incapable of doing for mine, which was to remember him to the point that I don't think there was a dry eye left in that entire auditorium. All the capacities that Mr. Frohnmayer served in throughout his distinguished public sector career were remembered that day with different segments and different folks commenting on them. But it is imperative that this legislative session remember and memorialize and honor this fine Oregonian by passing House Concurrent Resolution 27. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for your record, my name is Marla Ray. Bill Gary and I we met in 1981 in the Attorney General's office when both Bill and Dave Frohnmayer worked for me. You can laugh at any point in this. One of us is the professional one, and one is the irreverent one, and I will leave it to you to figure out which is which.
Oh, such tough choices.
It is. given his just Dave persona in so many ways, it was not at all intimidating for a Jefferson County farm kid to go to work for an Ivy Leaguer and Rhodes Scholar, because he truly was just Dave. Throughout the years, Dave and I have this, we picked it up, the line in Washington, D.C. from a colleague of his, and I stole it because I learned a long time ago that in politics, if it's a good line, steal it. So I had several occasions publicly to say that I had carried Dave Frohnmayer longer than his mama. In the early days, he was a little bit concerned about his public image. He gave a major speech in Eugene to a large group of business people about an alarming trend in drugs and the increasing public intolerance of those massive amounts of drugs that were coming into Oregon. So imagine Dave's chagrin when the Register Guard news story headline was, "Frohnmayer on drugs, people are fed up." We've had that blown up into big pictures throughout the years, and they hang in his son Mark's, in his son's office. The resolution, I think, captures the essence of Dave Frohnmayer, his contributions to his native state of Oregon, and for the irreverent part, I'll turn it over to Bill.
Thank you. Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, I'm Bill Gary. I'm a lawyer from Eugene. I came here this afternoon really only because Marla Ray told me that she was planning to testify in favor of the House concurrent resolution, and I thought I better be here to win back the constitutional majority that this resolution deserves. I want to thank both on my for myself and on behalf of the Frohnmayer family, thank the sponsors of this measure, all 32 of you. I can't remember the last time I testified in favor of a bill where I had as much confidence as to what the outcome would be. As Marla said, I first got to know Dave Frohnmayer when he and I were working for Marla in the Department of Justice. Marla and I were teenagers at the time. I served both as Solicitor General and then as his Deputy Attorney General in the Department of Justice. And what I would tell you about serving in the department, and I know that I speak for hundreds of people who'd had that privilege during his tenure, is that Dave Frohnmayer had a unique way to make the career professionals within the Department of Justice believe that public service is in fact a noble endeavor. He made us proud to be assistant attorneys general. And he made us believe that we could play on a national field, that being in a state like Oregon, you could still have an influence not just on the laws and the policies within the state, but in the nation. And through his service as president of the National Association of Attorneys General, the winning 6 out of 7 cases in the United States Supreme Court, he demonstrated to us that we really could make a difference. And he made us believe that we could be the best Department of Justice in the country. And I think during those years, just about everybody familiar with state AGs would agree that that was the case. If you look for a legacy for Dave Frohnmayer, I've in recent weeks come really to appreciate this to be the case. It isn't so much the opinions that he wrote, the laws that he sponsored when he was a member of this body, or the cases that he won. It's not even the buildings that exist on the University of Oregon campus because he served for 15 years as the president, or the new programs that he started, or any of the things that you can say about what he accomplished during his career. His legacy is to be found in the hundreds, literally hundreds, of judges and professors and local government lawyers and private lawyers and public lawyers whose career was inalterably changed by their contact with Dave Fronemeyer, by being inspired to try to make a difference in the world. And I had the privilege when he stepped down as the president of the university to work again with him for about 5 years when he served as of counsel to the law firm of which I am a partner. And I can tell you that during that period of time, in the years since he stopped being the president of the university, he was, without a doubt, the busiest retired person I have ever met. He spent the overwhelming majority of his time during those years on what we lawyers sometimes call pro bono work. He was teaching all the time. He served on public boards, such as the board of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and others that I couldn't even begin to name all of them. He spent a tremendous amount of his time and energy working with his wife, Lynn, to find a cure for Fanconi anemia. And he spent a tremendous amount of time and energy writing and thinking deeply about government and leadership. But it was only upon his passing that I came to understand that it wasn't just the people that had the good fortune to work with him who were touched by the genius of Dave Fronemeyer, but also the thousands of people who came in contact with him over the course of his career as a student, as a colleague, as somebody that they ran into in the supermarket, whose lives were affected. He taught a class on leadership beginning when he became the president of the University of Oregon. He taught it through the Honors College. It was open to all entering freshmen. And he loved teaching that class, and he taught it right up till the week before he passed away. There was a small candlelight service. It was spring break. Attendance wasn't as much as it otherwise would have been the week that he died. And it was put on by the students of this leadership class that he taught. And they spoke eloquently, more eloquently, I think, than I could have, about what it meant to learn the importance of leadership from somebody like Dave Fronemeyer. And I sometimes, as I'm sure we all do, become discouraged at the state of the world and the character of political discourse that has become what we live with, what you all live with every day. I have to tell you that I was inspired and encouraged listening to these young people. There is hope for our country and for our state. And I think Dave Fronemeyer recognized that the thing that he could have the most impact on in his life was by touching the lives of these young future leaders. And we are so blessed that he was willing and able to spend the final years of his life doing that. So thank you for this resolution. Thank you for hearing me out. Thanks.
Thank you for sharing that story and those stories and for coming and testifying today. Truly a great man. Comments from committee? Yes, Representative Wilson.
Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you so much for your testimony today. I grew up in the 1300 block of Lonridge Avenue in Grants Pass, the same block where Lynn and her brother Larry grew up, and so Larry was a childhood friend of mine. But Dave could make chairing a committee, any committee, look just absolutely effortless. He contributed in a really special way, and you know, I don't know how many people would even remember it, but back in, I think, 2005, he chaired a committee made up of 30 Oregonians. It was called the Public Commission on the Oregon Legislature, a group that hasn't been convened very often in state history. But the particular group that, you know, this particular group came up with a lot of interesting things that the legislature is doing now. But the thing that I remember about him is he just made getting such a diverse group of Oregonians together and working together, made it look easy the way he did it. And just a great example of something that I'll never forget watching him do. He's a great man. So thank you very much.
Yes.
I might just add for the benefit of colleagues, the University of Oregon very generously put many of Mr. Frohnmayer's writings up on their website, and he has one particular speech that is a favorite of mine that is a riff on the exchange with Lyndon Johnson about, I wish he'd run for sheriff. I wish he'd run for sheriff just once. It is a fabulous piece of writing, and all of us that have the opportunity to serve in public life would benefit from reading it. It's a terrific piece of writing, and it's up on the website.
Fantastic. Thank you. Anything else from the committee?
Okay.
Oh, okay. We're in work session. Representative Gilliam.
Then, Madam Chair, it's my privilege to move HCR 27 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved HCR 27 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion or objection? Yes, Representative Kenema.
Yes, I didn't realize there'd be so little testimony because Dave had a fabulous impact on my life and so many others. And it's an honor. Thank you for bringing this.
Great. Thank you very much. With that, if there's no objection, the motion passes, and the carriers will be myself and Representative Gilliam, the request of the family. Now, I'm going to close public hearing and work session and open public hearing and work session on H.R. 7, Carl Deese. And Representative Frederick.
Thank you very much. I was going to testify a little bit on Dave Frohnmayer, but you've already passed it. I would just say that I was lucky enough to get a chance to know him and work with him on different things as a reporter and afterwards when he was president of University of Oregon. So he was also the funniest, one of the best interviews you could possibly have as a reporter because at one time I came in to talk with him. And he jumped up from his chair and jumped. I'm sorry, I'm Representative Lou Frederick, District 43, North and Northeast Portland. He jumped up from his chair, wrapped himself in the flag, and said, I'm ready now for my interview. It was perfect. I really want to talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about Carl Deese. If you didn't meet him, you missed an opportunity for a number of reasons, both historic opportunity and because he could tell a pretty good story, and because he managed to, he and his wife, Mercedes Diaz, who was a court, district court judge for, and the first African-American woman to become a lawyer, to pass the bar in the state of Oregon. And the two of them raised three people who I would call young people. They are actually Bill Diaz, Gilbert Diaz, and Karen. Bill is several years older than me. Gilbert and I worked together as he was a photographer and I was a reporter. He is a photographer for CBS now. And Karen unfortunately died about 5 years ago. Seven years ago. She was also very made a major contribution to Oregon and to Portland. Carl Deese, however, made a major contribution to the nation. One of the ways that he did that is that he was one of Oregon's 12 members of the Tuskegee Airmen. He and his brother went to Tuskegee to train to be airmen at a time when, if you have seen any of the movies, The Red Tails or any of the other movies of Tuskegee Airmen, you know the story, the fact that they were not allowed to, they did not expect that African Americans could fly planes, which sounds really strange right now, but that's exactly what they were told, and that they were certainly not going to be able to be fighters. So they trained folks, got them over to Europe, and they gave them secondhand planes and said, we will just have you sort of act as scouts for the most part. They finally were allowed by way of a great deal of effort, to be fighter pilots and to escort bomber units and others throughout World War II, and racked up such a list of awards and recommendations that people are still amazed by it. But they were determined. They were determined to make a difference for this, for the country. And Carl Diaz, unfortunately, because of something that happened just before he was supposed to leave, he wasn't able to get over to Europe. His brother, however, did. Robert did get over to Europe, became a fighter pilot, and part of the story, the historic fiction story of the Red Tails is based around some of the things that Robert Diaz did. In fact, Robert Diaz became literally the poster child for the Tuskegee Airmen. The two of them graduated from Franklin High School, and there were posters at one time around Franklin High School of Robert Diaz, because he was well known as a Tuskegee Airman. Carl Diaz was a Tuskegee Airman as well. When he came back, he ended up working for BPA and a number of other places. But they made a name for themselves and were made major contributions to North and Northeast Portland as well. And so I wanted to honor them. I wanted to honor Carl Diaz, certainly. He died last year, and he was quite a guy. And I got a chance, I made it a point of whenever I was in that particular section of North Portland of stopping by and saying hello. I saw him last about a year ago or so, a year and a half ago. And he was not really agile at that point, but he came to the door and had me come in, and we talked a little bit about what had been going on with him. He seemed to be doing well. He died at age 94, so he was doing pretty well with that. I also should say that wasn't the only one in my family tracking the Tuskegee Airmen. My mother is an official Tuskegee Airman, according to General. I'm trying to remember his name now. I will get it. Benjamin O. Davis. General Davis made my mother an official Tuskegee Airman. My folks live in Tuskegee now, right next to the Tuskegee Airmen's Museum and their airport there. But she was always asking about Carl Diaz and how he was doing. And so she was also saddened. We now have about 20 Tuskegee Airmen still alive across the country. It would be good to be able to honor him right now, to say, here's one of ours, one of Oregon's. So I'd like for you to pass this. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any questions, comments from the committee? All right. With that, Representative Gilliam?
Just before I do, Representative, I did not know that both brothers went to Franklin, which is
your Franklin,
my high school.
That's right. That's your alma mater.
And I'm wondering if Franklin has ever, as a high school, has ever recognized them or done anything.
I do know that in the 90s, they had at least one or two events with Franklin, that Carl Diaz went to. I don't think that Robert Diaz died about 1993. I believe that's right. I know that they had at least one event. Oh, he died in 92. Sometime in the mid-90s, he at least attended one event. And Carl Diaz also attended a couple of events. He was that were at Milwaukee High School and several other high schools. But he attended the opening of the Red Tails movie, just so that he could sit back. And he was the oldest one in the room.
That's really
and
cool.
I was able to see what they did fictionally with him. So they were pleased with that.
All right, Madam Chair, then I will move House Resolution 7 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved House Resolution 7 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? If not, motion passes. Representative Frederick, would you carry this on the floor? Thank you. Okay, with that, I will open a public hearing and work session on HCR 25. Aaron, will you Describe the measure.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. HCR 25 honors the life of Shirley Kalkoven.
Madam Chair, for the record, Betsy Johnson, Senate District 16, and before, oops, he's already left, Representative Fredericks leaves the room, I had the privilege of knowing both Judge Diaz and Carl Diaz, and having spent my whole professional life in aviation, I can tell you that the Tuskegee Airmen are the thing of legend. They had to do everything everybody else did, only they did it better. Legendary airmen, so I'm so glad that you moved ahead with that. I'm here today for House Concurrent Resolution 25 in honor of Shirley Kalkoven. My two colleagues are going to speak about the merits of the bill. I would just tell her that that was a busy week for me. I was a eulogist for Shirley Kalkoven as well. Everybody on the coast had Shirley on speed dial. She was the go-to girl for practically everything. She was the mayor of Nehalem, but her presence was felt statewide. She was heavily involved in transportation issues, chaired our Area Commission on Transportation. I'll leave the details to my colleagues. A remarkable woman. Who literally died with her high heels on. She was polishing testimony for the OTC the weekend that she was stricken with a massive stroke. I was talking to the person she was emailing back and forth with, and the question was, you know, I didn't get a response from Shirley. I wonder what happened, and then tragically we all found out. That is exactly the way that Shirley would have wanted to go. At a very advanced age, more than a normal person's expected lifetime to be in the game right until the end. And so I'll leave the details to my colleagues, but a remarkable lady, and I'm glad we have the chance to honor her if the committee moves favorably on the bill.
Thank you.
I'm
going
to excuse myself and go to my own committee.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. Deborah Boone, House District 32, for the record. And I, too, am here to honor Shirley Kalkoven, who, as Senator Johnson so ably described, was the go-to girl. And this girl was 80-some years old. 87, thank you. And it's true about the high heels. She never went anywhere without her Manolos. So, and then she had more pair than Imelda, I'm sure. But Shirley was, we had this drafted, and you can see the tiny print on it. This is about a quarter of the items that we would have put in if we thought we could get away with a four-pager, because we want to be able to frame this. But it gives you a little bit of an idea of what she did in her life, which started after her children were raised and her business. She was still doing her business a little bit, but there was a point when I guess her husband had died, and she told her son, I'm not cooking anymore. And at that point, she got busy again, more busy than she already was. But they had a business, a cabinet building business. Our business used them quite a bit. And at the same time, she was on city council. I think she put 20-some years into public service. And she's been on Beaverton School Board, I think she started. But it all is listed in this resolution here for that will honor some, I have to say, about a quarter of what she actually did. She was an incredible woman. Well-liked and well-respected in our area and around the state, and literally knew everybody and everything. And so if you really wanted to save time and you had a question about something that was going on in many of these sectors, you called Shirley. And she also was the recipient of a very prestigious award, which she took in stride and was, I think, a little embarrassed by. So I hope that you will consider this favorably today, and we will honor, we would like to have her family at the floor vote for this. Her kids were, she had a huge, huge ceremony memory of her life in Tillamook, and it was standing room only. They had 350 chairs, and there were people around the edges. And fortunately, the fire marshal was there, so everything was cool. And you can strike that from the record. But it was an incredible showing of faith and appreciation and admiration and love for this incredible woman. God rest Shirley Kalkoven.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Mark Labhart, and I have the privilege of being a Tillamook County Commissioner. Shirley was no Dave Frommeyer, but Shirley was a person, each of your districts, I'm sure you have people in each of your districts that stand out and are go-to people. Shirley was one of those for the north coast of Oregon. But then she expanded beyond that, president of the League of Oregon Cities, President of Northwest, or Chair of the Northwest Area Commission on Transportation, and the list goes on and on, but she was a volunteer on all of these groups. She had a little pickup that she drove around. She put 200,000 miles on that pickup. She was gone all the time. I just want to read you some quotes, what others say about this outstanding lady of 87 years old and how vibrant and powerful she was. Lisa Van Lannen, the Oregon State Parks Director, she says, Shirley was a great leader, inspiration to so many, partner, and most of all, an incredible person. She's a volunteer's volunteer. She was everywhere. She did this all with no pay. I can't imagine how many miles she put on her little truck for the betterment of the Columbia Pacific Economic Development District, Northwest Area Commission on Transportation, League of Oregon Cities, City of Nehalem, and on and on. When Shirley showed up, you'd better listen, because she had done her homework and she had the passion with what she was about to say. Ono Husing, the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Association, up and down the entire coast. Of all the people I've met on the Oregon coast over the years, and that's a lot of people, Shirley Kalkoven may have been the most effective individual I ever encountered, and he was chair of that commission for a lot of years. Judd Randall, who was one of the editors of the Oregonian a number of years ago, said this, a friend of Shirley's, in short order, I came to deeply appreciate Shirley's experience, broad wisdom about all manner of public engagement. Her ability to cut to the core of the issues and clearly see resolutions was eye-opening to me. And then I just want to read you something that I hope will make your day. This is from Larry McKinley. He's an ODOT employee, area manager up in Astoria. And he hadn't met Shirley before when he first came to Astoria, and he tried to do the ODOT thing and develop a relationship. He says, one of my favorite memories of Shirley is when she booked a cruise to Alaska to celebrate her 80th birthday. He said, I've only known her for a short period of time, and at that point, in an attempt to make small talk with her, I mentioned I'd heard she was planning a cruise to Alaska. One thing led to the other, and I asked her if she was traveling with a friend. It was at that point that I gained a new perspective on Shirley Kalkoven, and when she looked me straight in the eye and she said, hell no, none of my friends drink scotch. So that's the way Shirley was. What a wonderful lady. He said he'll never forget the time that she played in all of our lives. So I know you each have people like that in your districts. Shirley Kalkoven was a friend of mine for 30 years. The 12 years I've been county commissioner, I relied on Shirley for counsel and advice, and every bit of it was great. There are some wonderful people in this state of Oregon, and there's some wonderful ladies in the state of Oregon that represent us well, and Shirley Kalkoven was one of those, and I encourage your support for that. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both for sharing such great testimony. What a wonderful woman. Great life to celebrate. Any comments? Questions? Okay, with that, I'll accept a motion.
Okay, Madam Chair, I am glad to move HCR 25 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved HCR 25 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, motion passes. Representative Boone, would you like to carry this on the floor? Thank you. Okay, close the public hearing on HJM 25 and open a public hearing on HJM 16. Erin, will you describe the measure?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. HJM 16 urges Congress to work with Turkish diplomats, European Union, and NATO allies to stop mass arrest and detainment of journalists in Turkey.
With that, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Hoyle and distinguished members of the House Committee on Rules, thank you for hearing HJM 16 today. My name is Rep. Jim Widener from House District 24, which encompasses most of Yamhill County and Washington County, or Southwest Washington County. HJM 16 deals with a very important issue, the inalienable right to free speech and the necessity of a free press in any democracy. It has been an honor and a pleasure to reconnect and work alongside Commissioner Jules Bailey and members of the Turkish community here in Portland. You can find a letter of support from Commissioner Bailey and letters from members of the Turkish community on OLUS. I'm sure that many of you already are aware this past December, a nationwide crackdown on free speech has taken place in Turkey, jailing journalists critical of the government, Furthermore, this turbulent news reported on foreign journalists being expelled, censorship of websites, and forced closure of TV stations. Turkey has routinely been under scrutiny for such actions, but recently the level of media suppression has reached new heights in Turkey. You may be asking, why are we talking about free speech in Turkey? I can give you three very good reasons why we are talking about free speech in Turkey here today. First, in the spirit of friendship, we cannot stay silent when an ally country like Turkey is infringing upon the universal human right of free speech. Turkey is a United States ally, a member of NATO, and has publicly expressed their desire to join the EU. They need to curtail the stifling of free speech and become recommitted to the spirit of a free democratic society. Secondly, we are supporting our two Oregon federal senators, Wyden and Merkley, who co-signed alongside 72 other senators urging Secretary Kerry to work diligently on the freedom of press issues in Turkey. Please read the letter we have uploaded on OLIS from the office of Senator Schumer and Senator Wicker. Thirdly, no one and even no state is an island unto itself. The interconnectedness of people, commodities, cultures, and business around the globe require that us here in the United States who can use a voice to do so consistently in the promotion of free democratic societies that elevates the human condition should do so. Having the freedom to criticize the government is a hallmark in the American experience and in all free democratic societies. Here in the United States, the First Amendment is the principal guarantee against corruption because basic free expression is a political opinion, serves to educate the citizenry and to test the merit in the free marketplace of ideas. Thomas Jefferson said, "The only security of all is in a free press. Where the press is free and every man able to read, all is safe." President Kennedy said, "Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed and no republic can survive." But the importance of free press and speech is universal in those societies who seek self-governance through democracy. And it was Nelson Mandela who said, "A critical, independent, and investigative press is the lifeblood of any democracy." The founder of the Republic of Turkey would agree. It was Mustafa Kemal Atatürk who declared that no country is free unless it's democratic. Oregon has a forward-thinking tradition of humanitarian perspective that has resulted in numerous resolutions, divestitures, and other memorials just like this. We have a sizable population of Turkish Americans living in Oregon. Again, Turkey is a NATO ally and until recently was model for democratic reform with free elections and freedom of expression, press, and media. The harassment of journalists include Americans like Ivan Watson from CNN, who was detained before being expelled from Turkey. The international community has rallied around these basic human rights, and the United States must always champion these ideals. We need a stable and democratic Turkey allied with the U.S. and NATO, which influences the stability of all governments in the Middle East region. We should pass this memorial and add our voice alongside our federal delegates and the European Union about this important debate about freedom of the press and the role of government. And I thank you for your time and attention on this HJM today and would urge its passage. Thank you.
Thank you. So who would like to go next, Ms. Nato or Mr. Kabai?
Chair Hoyle and members of the House Committee on Rules, my name is Yarjanat Kabai. You may have been following the turbulent news about the erosion of democracy in Turkey. We watch with heavy hearts the jailing of journalists critical of the government, expulsion of foreign journalists like Ivan Watson from CNN, the censorship of websites and forced closures of TV stations. I urge you to consider supporting HJM 16, urging Congress to work with Turkish diplomats, the European Union, and other NATO allies to stop the infringement on the basic human right of free press, which is essential to all democratic societies. The European Union adopted a similar resolution, and this memorial would urge Congress to adopt and send a companion resolution. The international community is rallying around these basic human rights, and we would be honored to have the Oregon legislature initiate this historic action here in the United States. I believe this support is important to establish democracy in Turkey that is essential milestone for the establishment of peace in the Middle East. Thank you for your support.
Thank you very much. Ms. Nato.
Thank you, Chair Hoyle and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lisa Nato, and I'm speaking here today as an individual citizen. It's fitting, I think, to consider this memorial today in light of your earlier action in honoring the life of Dave Frohmeyer and his work. He was my law professor in constitutional law and legislative administrative processes, and I can tell you on behalf of my whole law school class, we appreciate the action that you took in honoring him today. He was someone who fought for justice in our community, and this resolution has a similar effect. I urge your support of this resolution. I met many of our Turkish friends in Portland through the Pacifica Institute some years ago and was invited to take an interfaith and intercultural trip to Turkey. We were invited into people's homes, we visited schools, and we visited some members of the news media as well. It's those very news media members who are now being subject to arrest and detaining. We are really alarmed at the actions that are taking in this civil society. It has been a secular government since the founding of the first president of Turkey, Ataturk, as was said by Representative Widener. So thank you for your action today. Thank you for standing up for free speech and for individual liberties. We appreciate your action. And I want to mention appreciation to Jameson Gideon, who was also on the trip to Turkey, and that's how I met him and became involved with this organization.
Any questions or comments from the panel? For the panel. Thank you. Very proud to be a co-sponsor with you on this bill. And again, would like to thank Jameson Gideon, without whom this would not have been possible.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just a comment. Thank you for bringing this important matter to us. Been to Turkey and have some empathy, and this is a very sad development, and it's appropriate to stand up and call it wrong. Thank you.
Ejecular.
Thank you. I'd accept a motion. We're not moving it. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM 16 and open a public hearing on HB 3518, the local government insolvency bill. So, Erin, would you describe the measure?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3518 requires governing body of local government or special government body to notify governor when local government or special government is insolvent. It authorizes governor in certain circumstances to take certain actions to resolve state of fiscal emergency in insolvent local government or special government. Authorizes governor to establish fiscal emergency oversight board for local government or the special government in a state of fiscal emergency. It authorizes the board on behalf of the local or special government to file petition and seek all relief available to municipality under federal bankruptcy law. Provides circumstances in which governor may terminate board's oversight of the local or special government. There is an emergency clause on this measure. We do not have a fiscal nor a revenue impact statement issued yet on the measure.
Okay, I'd like to call up Rob Bavette, Oren Haker, and Lloyd Hanyon. Okay, he's not here, so you may.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bavette, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. I'll just speak for a very few brief seconds and set the stage for why we have this bill in front of you. As you may be aware, there is fiscal distress legislation that is currently on the books. It is set to expire, I'm trying to remember, 2017, I believe. It's got a sunset date on it. It's never been used. I suspect it never will because it's structurally not attractive. What we are looking to do is find permanent statutory authority to deal with fiscal distress for all municipalities that is practical and workable. And so with that in mind, I've worked with Oren Haker, you're going to hear from in just a moment, on crafting the bill that you have in front of you designed to replace that legislation with something that could actually be used. Now, the good news is that it looks like that Congress will be passing an extension of the Secure Rural Schools, the SRS, so we may have a little bit more time, which is good news. But I think it's really vital that we get something workable on the books here in Oregon in case one of our members has to use these provisions to deal with fiscal distress. The bill we crafted was modeled, as Orna will explain, in part on legislation from other states. So with that, I'll turn it over to Orna.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Orna Haker. I'm an attorney specializing in insolvency and financial restructurings and reorganizations. I currently live and practice law in Portland, Oregon. Over the past decade, I've had the privilege of working on behalf of businesses, nonprofits, government entities, as they've dealt with macroeconomic, industry-specific, and general market distress. In particular, during the 2008 Great Recession, I advised President Obama's auto task force in connection with the restructurings of General Motors and Delphi Automotive. I've also advised one of the largest nonprofit hospitals in the country as it navigated federal bankruptcy process and attempt to reorganize its business and restructure its financial obligations. My perspective, and I think this bill's perspective, on fiscal distress, whether at the municipal, corporate, or individual level, is colored by the fact that I've actually sat on all sides of the table when it comes to devising solutions to financial distress. This bill is about process above all. And in my view, the key to solving financial distress is to create an environment that facilitates growth and revenue generation, and that can only be done by convincing all sorts of interested parties to look to the future rather than the past. House Bill 3518 creates a process that currently is lacking in Oregon. It empowers local governments and the state to work together to resolve local distress. And what I'd like to do is spend a couple minutes, I think there are materials, PowerPoint slides, walking through the actual bill, how it works. I think it's important to do in part because this is a process. This isn't a bill that seeks a certain outcome. This isn't a bill that picks winners or losers. It's a bill that adopts a mechanism that first and foremost needs to be supported by the state, both financially and I think with political muscle. The current law puts the at least part of the financial burden on the entities that are in distress to fund the process. That's one of the reasons why, frankly, I think it's been a non-starter. But anyway, let me, if I can direct your attention to slide two, or page two of the slides. In terms of just a general overview here, the purpose here is to provide local governments, whether they're cities, towns, special districts, water districts, irrigation districts, drainage districts, counties, school districts, both leverage and flexibility. The role of government isn't to pay its obligations. And I say that with the full comprehension that that could be interpreted a number of different ways. But, you know, government we have government to provide taxpayers and citizens with services, and when governments get into financial distress, they need the leverage to negotiate with creditors, residents, taxpayers, and frankly the state as well. And what we need is a process that isn't court-based, that isn't based on litigation. Litigation only benefits one constituency, and that is generally the attorneys litigating whatever matters before the court. The second purpose, or the second prong here that we're looking for, is flexibility. And the flexibility is to essentially adjust the liability side of a balance sheet. Now, municipal government's no different than a business in that it has operating costs. And when a business gets into trouble, when a municipality gets in trouble, it needs the flexibility to adjust its liability side. The asset side and liability side are interconnected. Investment tends to shy away from over-leveraged entities, whether they're municipalities or private business. And in order to foster innovation, in order to foster growth, to allow municipalities the flexibility to adjust their liability side of their balance sheet, I think especially in light of the 2008 recession, it's a must these days. And the key here, again, coming back to process, is a municipality should only be authorized to do so once it's jumped through a number of hoops, jumped over a number of hurdles, and it basically participated in a collaborative process that involves the state, involves elected officials, involves taxpayers, and involves the local government leaders. So now to the nuts and bolts of the actual bill. The bill is we've kept it as simple as possible, and I find that the clearer you can be, the less litigious things turn out to be. Now that's always a hope and an aim, and not always how things end up, but we've really taken a scalpel to define what insolvency means here. Because if you look at a balance sheet and you take long-term liabilities, everyone's insolvent, right? So what we're talking about here is service level insolvency. We're talking about going concern insolvency. We're talking about a risk that I may have to turn the lights off because I can't pay my bills. This has nothing to do with adding up all your long-term liabilities and comparing them with your assets and saying, you know, where are we? This is about present-day distress. This is about distress that exists this year, next year, maybe the following year. That's it. So insolvency is defined as going concern insolvency, which I think is very important. I like to refer to it as service level insolvency. The governments are in the business of providing services. If those services can't be provided, there's a fiscal, what I'll refer to as, and what we refer to in the bill as fiscal distress. Another way to define insolvency here is for the patient to raise its hand and say, I'm having a problem. And the bill allows for that too. It empowers the local government to make a determination that it can't provide services or that it's having a difficult time providing services. And in other words, the patient says, I'm sick, and engages in a conversation with the state. So if you turn to page 4, I've outlined the process triggers. Okay, how does this bill actually, at what point does this bill come into play? And there's really five triggers here in the bill. One, as I just noted, the patient identifies itself and says, I'm having a problem here. And the local government notifies the governor of the insolvency event, the fiscal distress. Second option is a petition signed by 5% of voters in the municipality in the last general election, notifying both the local government and the governor of the insolvency event. This allows taxpayers to raise their hand and say, we've got a problem down here, we need help. The third, default to PERS. Pension obligations are sacrosanct under state law, and if there's been a municipal default to PERS, that should raise a red flag. The fourth, again, putting aside the local level now, taxpayers, local government officials, let's look at the governor saying, we have a problem. Maybe the local officials say, you know, let's hold off, but the governor, in consult with the Secretary of State and Treasurer, determines that an insolvency event has occurred. And the last is that the Senate or House passes a resolution declaring a fiscal emergency. Now, I want to draw a distinction here. The last prong is a declaration of a fiscal emergency. I do believe, and we do believe, and there are others out there that believe, that the process shouldn't get hijacked or be hijacked by one or two people or in the office of one or two elected officials. So if the Senate or the House passes a resolution declaring a fiscal emergency, that triggers this bill. And I think, you know, with all these different process triggers, you basically create a system that is attempting to be preventative and to identify issues before they become real emergencies. If we turn to page 5. The bill empowers the governor or a fiscal emergency oversight board to act upon a declaration of a fiscal emergency. I just identified one way that could happen. The Senate or the House passes a resolution stating that there is a fiscal emergency. Another independent method for doing this, and the bill outlines, is, you know, upon, let's say, the local government or the governor identifying fiscal distress, the governor engages in a process with the local municipality to request information from the local government and an action plan for resolving the insolvency event. The local government has 45 days to respond in writing. And this is, again, designed to get both parties sitting down, trying to work out a resolution, or at least get in the same room and identify the problem. Oftentimes, you may have a situation and different folks are identifying different problems. And so everyone needs to be in the same room. The governor then, in consult with the Secretary of State and Treasurer, and others, frankly, shall determine whether the local government needs state assistance. Now, one thing that I want to emphasize here is across the country, you have essentially in states where there isn't a debt adjustment law on the books, you have states essentially serving as the guarantor of last resort. If there isn't an ability to modify or restructure debt, the state as sovereign is essentially guaranteeing the debt. So when a local municipality can't pay its bills, the state is on the hook, whether the state likes to or not. Now, municipal distress and local government distress isn't unique to local government. States are in distress. The federal government's in distress. The one difference here is, unlike the federal government, states can't print money. So if you don't have an ability to adjust debt, you are making promises that you know you can't pay without an ability to modify them. And when the asset side or the revenue side, when the asset side of a balance sheet or the revenue side of an income statement drops or is somehow affected adversely, you need certain flexibility on the liability side too. So, you know, from my perspective and from our perspective, I think here both local government and the state are on the same side. And I think that's true because the state essentially is a guarantor of last resort. So this slide and the bill illustrates there are really two ways to get to a declaration of fiscal emergency. And upon a declaration of fiscal emergency, whether it's from the Senate or the House or the governor, the governor has the ability to establish a fiscal emergency oversight board. And this board is self-policing, just like any company would be. It has bylaws. It holds regular meetings. It elects a chair. It maps out what the scope of its duties are. It must be comprised of members with expertise in the areas relevant to the fiscal emergency. So depending on whether the municipality is a political municipality, a city or a county, or whether it's a special purpose entity, drainage district, you would have a fiscal emergency oversight board that is comprised of members that understand the issues and can come up with a resolution. Now, one of the Fiscal Emergency Oversight Board is tasked with coming up with a plan of action, a plan of adjustment. They have significant powers. It's not almost synonymous to a court receiver, court-appointed receiver. There's an interesting case from 1933, City of Enterprise v. State. Oregon Supreme Court ruled that Oregon passed a Municipal Administration Act in 1933 that actually allowed for what we're talking about today. And it was declared unconstitutional by the Oregon Supreme Court because it allowed, it basically authorized the administrator to be court appointed, and the Oregon Supreme Court ruled that it was separation of powers violation. So what we have here today, and why this, we believe, is constitutional, is all of the authority remains within the executive. This isn't a court process, as I outlined earlier.
Yes, Representative McClain.
I noticed in the bill that this board would have the ability to cut the expenses of the county. Does the board have the ability to raise the revenues of the county?
My understanding, and I'm not a home rule expert, but that would step on the shoes of the political process. So the answer is I don't believe so. The Fiscal Emergency Oversight Board could certainly put forth a plan of adjustment that would have as a component a tax increase. But that, I believe, would have to be approved by the elected official or the elected officials. That's my understanding.
Okay, whether it has to be approved by the people or the elected officials as to tax increase, I'll leave that to later discussion. What about fee obligations? In other words, you know, just raising fees.
The Fiscal Emergency Oversight Board would have the power to raise fees.
My print's really small here.
And the bill itself doesn't go into, doesn't specifically address both questions, but the intent here is to give it as much power as constitutionally permissible. Again, what you want here is where the political process is failing, you want to bring in a separate board to have the ability to propose a plan of action that might not have support, political support, but that may be necessary.
May I follow up? How do you define the political process failing?
Well, there are a number of I guess, examples I could give. I don't have any specific off the top of my head, but one would be, let's say, local officials are looking for a way to raise revenue, and every time someone tries to raise revenue, they end up out of office. That to me would be maybe a breakdown of trying to get a result that is necessary.
Well, I don't doubt you see that as true, but I'm not sure how that is a political failure.
Well, maybe I'm making a value judgment there and I shouldn't. Let's just say that one of the issues here, and I think one of the issues you're touching on, is do we leave the revenue side solely to the political process, or do we allow the Fiscal Emergency Oversight Board to come in and propose certain revenue adjustments? Certainly, this bill does allow for that. I think you could.
Or revenue adjustments?
It does. But you could limit it to only dealing with the liability side, right? So you could say that the Fiscal Emergency Oversight Board can only propose a plan that that adjusts existing contractual obligations.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Rayfield and then Representative Wilson.
I haven't gotten to the I was curious, when can a city, county, other subdivision, can it be determined that they are not insolvent? So let's say that the board enacts itself, the folks are, when does this end? what period is there a regular review? Does that automatically happen?
There are a couple of ways for it to happen. One would be the governor disbands the actual board. Generally, the way this is designed is it would come upon a recommendation by the board that the fiscal emergency is no longer, has been resolved. Maybe it's been resolved naturally. Maybe a plan of adjustment has been put into place, and the fiscal emergency oversight board no longer has a role to play. But generally, to answer your question, the governor would have the ability to disband the board.
So if the local entity believes that they are solvent, but the governing board has not made a recommendation to remove that, tough luck. There's nothing that they can do to appeal that process.
Well, the Fiscal Emergency Oversight Board would be comprised of a number of officials, and hopefully you would have a board that is representative of both state concerns and local concerns. Maybe you'd have a local representative on the actual board. The governor would be taking direction from the board. I think the governor needs to have the ability to disband the board because the governor shouldn't be working for the board. You know, arguably, now that you're talking about it, there could be a mechanism for allowing maybe local voters to disband the board after a period of time if they feel like there is, you know, it's counterproductive or it's not working. The costs of administering a fiscal emergency oversight board rest with the state. So I do think there is, well, I should say maybe a decent process there whereby if the board's relevance is diminishing, that the board will wrap up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am trying to superimpose this bill over the nature and disposition of my home county of Josephine, and I just don't see that working. Reading a couple of lines here on page 4 of the bill, all officers and employees of the local government or special government body shall cooperate with the Fiscal Emergency Oversight Board upon request. That doesn't play in Josephine County. That just wouldn't do that. I guess my question is, where does this bill idea really come from? I mean, who's behind it? Josephine County is always at the tip of the spear on issues like insolvency, and I've not heard from one county official about this bill. And I've just had an opportunity to run through it, and like I say, it just doesn't seem to match up with the nature or disposition of my home county. Where does this come from? Where did this come from?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, if I may, some contextual history here. In 2007, we had a task force convened by Governor Coon. Mike MacArthur, sure, sorry. Association of Macon Counties. We had a task force convened by Governor Coon-Gasky and made up, chaired by Commissioner Bobby Lee of Lane County, along with Tim Nesbitt of the governor's office, came up with 57 recommendations. One of them was that there be some sort of mechanism here for dealing with this insolvency problem, as we saw it coming, as the Secure Rural Schools apparently was going to expire at that time. So county officials have been involved since then in forming some sort of mechanism. The best we had was embodied in House Bill 3453 of last session, which is that rather radical notion of the governor coming in and imposing. So then along came Mr. Haker with his expertise. We were introduced to him and began to develop this concept as a more organized steps, more procedural process to get to dealing with that problem, because counties, after all, are agents of the state. It's a problem that the state would face should counties become insolvent. We don't have a provision for bankruptcy in Oregon law. And one of the reasons that we didn't have one, we were told, was that it would hurt the state's bond rating. And I'll let Mr. Haker address that, but in his experience, that hasn't been the case. So it's something that county commissioners, frankly, aren't real familiar with, this bill, because we just got it. And we haven't had a real thorough vetting of it, in fact, at AOC.
So we need to bring your commissioners along. That's the answer, I think.
Okay.
And Chair Hoyle, Representative Wilson, if I could add to that, the other complicating factor of 3518, although it was endorsed by AOC and actually has the support of the League of Oregon Cities as well, which I should have stated for the record at the beginning, we were originally thinking this bill was going to be assigned to House Revenue, and we were working with Representative Barnhart on this bill and others, and then all of a sudden you have it. And so we didn't really have time to talk with you about it, and that's probably my fault.
Any other questions or Mr. MacArthur, did you have anything else to add?
No, other than that, it's a work in progress. It's a better tool than we have now. I hope we can continue to develop it with your input. And it's something that I think, although we have a breather now, we have the 14th and 15th year of transitional payments from the federal government. We don't anticipate that can last forever. And those payments are at such a low level now, around less than 40% of the peak, that many of the counties are just barely hanging on.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add one more thing, which is that while we have this brief window of time with SRS extension, we feel a little bit of relief, but we really want to get something in place before the existing fiscal distress bill expires, just so we have something on the books. If it's in this form, maybe some of the amendments we've talked about, we're not sure. We can work this as a multi-session bill, but really we'd like to get something on the books in the next year or two.
Madam Chair, I appreciate all of your testimonies. I think the Obed, you phrase that the bill's not, the previous bill is not workable, sort of like saying, hey, that kid's ugly. You know, you might consider my kid ugly, but I think she's beautiful. So, you know, I'm very concerned about this bill. The last bill was pieced together in a way that I think is necessary to gain the political support to do something. I don't think this will have the political support. I think it's a long ways from being there. I think, you know, I think there's a lot of work, and we're late in April. This isn't the most this session is not about building consensus. And so given the way that the speaker has run this session, I doubt there's going to be any ability to really bring people together at this point to try to accomplish a legislation like this, especially when the counties that are hurting the most are the rural counties that have suffered the consequences of a lot of urban elitist ideals. So I think you're going to find a lot of resistance to this. So I look forward to seeing what adjustments you want to make, but I think you have to probably look down the road. I'd be surprised, you know, this is the first time I've seen this. I don't think Representative Wilson has seen it. You know, I think if you're going to bring something in the House, it'd be good to work, give heads up to the legislators that represent these areas that are going to be affected. But I can tell you what doesn't sell is a governor from Portland appointing a board to go govern Southern Oregon. That's a tough sell, especially this year. But hey, good luck. Appreciate your work.
Mr. Bovet, I also want to say I appreciate your work. And coming from one of the counties that is affected significantly by the loss of secure rural school funds, and as the legislator that was the co-chair with Representative Hanna on the last set of bills that we put forward to actually address the potential of our county is going bankrupt, and understanding that we as a state would have to figure out how to manage that, what would we do for emergency services? I appreciate you bringing this forward. I also, like my colleague, wasn't aware of the bill. I understand you were working at it in a different committee, and I can tell you that where I will leave out, you know, I'll leave out the political comments, but what I would say is that in this committee and specifically around these issues, that I would encourage you to bring the people who are affected to the table. I would agree with my colleague that having just the governor appointing this board is a non-starter. But I'm looking forward to work with you, and I know that my colleagues from the affected counties would be looking forward to work with you. I would hope that my colleagues on the other side of the aisle would also sit down and look and see what we can do. But I assure you that we have no intention of running something like this without involving the people who are affected. But I want to thank you for taking this first stab at it. This is a larger conversation and one that is very important. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I keep banging the same old drum here, but looking at legislation like this would be forestalled if we could just, as a legislature, really pledge to put the kind of energy that has obviously gone into this, tremendous amount of energy, if we could just simply put that into attention to my part of the world, Southern Oregon, and the economy. You know, when I read how well Oregon is doing and our unemployment rate is really getting down there, relatively speaking, and I consider that the real unemployment rate in my county is probably three times that. We're more than likely the real unemployment rate is 15%. And there's just no reason for that. And so I just hope that as we go on in the future, we can put the kind of effort into helping Southern Oregon grow and develop as it could so easily. If we could just put that kind of effort into that part of the world, we wouldn't have to spend so much time on these bailout issues that this is obviously designed to, quote-unquote, help us with. Thank you.
And again, I want to thank you for all the effort, because clearly you've put a lot of effort into it. So look forward to continuing the conversation. Representative Rayfield.
I actually just wanted to ask one other quick question as I was reading this. Is there a constitutional issue with essentially removing the power of elected officials to make decisions? And, you know, as you're going through this, obviously you've got local entities who, I mean, local voters who have put their trust in certain elected officials to essentially come into office and make these decisions, and then through legislation, essentially we're saying, no, you're now irrelevant, and we're going to be making all of these decisions. And actually, in the way that I read this, I actually do believe that this board could raise taxes, and specifically on in one of the subsections. So I was just kind of curious.
Sure.
I don't know. It's a fascinating question.
Yeah, and I think the answer is it is constitutional. I think the key here is two points. One is you're keeping all of the authority to act on behalf of the municipality within the executive branch. That's the first piece. The second is as a subdivisions of a sovereign. The sovereign is the state. It's not the local government, right? So the municipality is a piece of a sovereign, and the governor, arguably, this body can pass a law that authorizes the governor to step in the event of a fiscal emergency. And that's what you've seen. You've seen this now in about 27 other states have passed laws very similar to this. I mean, this law, it wasn't written from clean cloth. You know, I've studied a number of different laws around the country, including Michigan's, Florida's, South Carolina's. New Jersey now is in the process of trying to pass debt adjustment process. So many states are dealing with it, and how they're trying to deal with it is difficult because of two main issues, and they're constitutional issues. One is the federal constitution, which says you can't impair, no state can impair contractual obligations, right? And the other is most states
echo that, Oregon included. Existing contractual obligations can't be impaired. So, for instance, when you have, you know, PERS reform, oftentimes the refrain is, well, you can't affect existing contractual obligations. It's unconstitutional. That prohibition doesn't exist at the United States Congress nor in federal court. And that's the beauty. Well, I shouldn't say beauty when I'm talking about this kind of issue. So I use that word liberally or loosely. The value of this bill, frankly, is if you can't bring people to the table as an option of last resort, the governor could put a county, or a county could put itself, or a city could put itself into federal bankruptcy protection in an effort to adjust its debts, because Congress has passed the United States Bankruptcy Code. There is no United States constitutional prohibition on Congress passing laws that impair existing debts. Likewise, the minute you walk into federal bankruptcy court, the rules change. And there are ways to deal with, on one side you'll see, bondholders saying, well, wait a minute here. You know, if you allow for this kind of mechanism, you're going to raise the cost of borrowing. Well, you know, again, different states have dealt with it in different ways, and it's certainly worth exploring. Rhode Island dealt with it in a very unique way of passing a law that gave bondholders a statutory lien, which meant that they couldn't be impaired in a federal bankruptcy case proceeding. So there are ways to protect bondholders if you want to go that route. There are obviously ways to protect other creditors, depending upon how you want to, where you all come out, frankly. But the key here, the key in all of this, is the ability to write down debt that you cannot pay. And that's where we're coming from. That's what we're trying to do, is come up with a process that responsibly allows local government to adjust its debt. Not to walk away completely, but to adjust it. Now, 13 states, I think California was among them until recently, allow a municipality just to file. They can just file a petition in federal bankruptcy court without notifying anyone. So I fully sympathize with the concern that we don't want someone from Portland running the affairs of someone in Josephine County or Curry County. At the same time, the flip side, you don't want Curry County saying, you know, something to hell with it. I'm going into federal bankruptcy court, and I may take the state's credit rating with me, right? So there's got to be maybe a middle ground there, and coming up with that middle ground where local officials retain control, but through a process that involves the state, that's really what we're trying to get at here. To the extent this iteration of the bill strikes maybe a balance that's more heavily favored in the state, that can be adjusted. The key here is the ability to write down debt. You can't do that in state court. You can't pass a state law that says, you know something, all these existing obligations, we're just going to write them off. But you can do that in federal court, and that's what this bill is designed to allow Oregon's municipalities to get the benefit of if consensual workouts he can't get there. Apologies if I went on.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing and open a public hearing work session on HCR 24. Erin, explain the measure.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, HCR 24 honors Gretchen Kefauri. We are moving this today on behalf of the family so we can have it on the floor on May 1st, where the family will be able to attend the final reading and honoring of Gretchen Kefauri.
Okay, accept a motion.
Madam Chair, in respect for this family, this is 24. I move HCR 24 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has motioned that HCR 24 go to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there discussion? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to briefly say I was honored to be able to attend Gretchen Kafoury's memorial service. I only met her a few times, but know her daughter, Chair Kafoury of Multnomah County, pretty well as a former colleague of many of the folks here. And it was an incredibly inspiring event through which I really felt like I got exposed to such the amazing spectrum of what and who she was as a person and as a public servant. And I think it'll really be a wonderful thing to be able to honor her through this.
Thank you. Any other discussion? All right, any objection? If not, the motion passes and carriers will be Representative Kotek and Taylor. Closed public hearing in the work session on HCR 24. We'll have informational hearings on Senate Bill 941 from 1 until 3, not informational hearings, invited testimony from 1 until 3 o'clock. We will then have public testimony from 3 o'clock until 10 o'clock. We'll take a break at 5:30 to 6 o'clock for dinner. And so plan to stay late on Wednesday. And if you have any questions, happy to answer them. And with that, no further business. The meeting's adjourned.